Thank you. I love that we get to share those moments together. We were with some good friends last night, who have adult children, but they also have some adolescent kids that are the same age as our youngest, Taya, are very similar age, and we were talking about their life with cell phones, and how this particular family, the parents are like, you know what, when you get home, You can just hand over your phone. You don't need that here. All the humans are in the building. And you can go read. You can go think. You can go listen to some music. You can go have a nap. You can go do something other than be on your phone. And that sometimes meets with some resistance. So, as you maybe can imagine. But it also sometimes meets with them coming back later and going, you know, I was kind of pissed off when you did that, but that was really good. I went and read an entire book, and it was a really great story, and, you know, thanks. Give me my phone. but it sort of filters down, you know? And I think sometimes I tell the story not as some kind of a, you know, phone screed, but rather by way of reflecting on the importance of moments of silence in our lives. I know that sometimes my head feels too full of ideas for me to do a good job focusing. Corrine is here this morning. She knows that in a way that very few other humans do. It's just like, uh-oh, Tim's left the grid again. Writing helps. Writing helps when I get like that. It puts some constraints on the whirl in my head, and it sort of forces me to leave some things to the side, you know? In lots of ways, what writing does is it forces me to go slow in a world that can be pretty insistent about going faster and faster. One of the things that can happen to us when we go too fast, too often, is that we stop feeling things. It's kind of like not noticing that you're developing a blister when you're in the heat of the game, you know, but when you sit down at the end and take your shoes off, there's this wound. And it's not going to heal faster just because you want to get back in the game. I heard a very smart person comment this week that some of the most important things about us as humans are things that AI will never be able to learn because we do them too slowly. That had never occurred to me before, that this might be an actual problem for the way AI learns. Feeling deeply is that sort of thing. It's not going to be readily turned into an algorithm because its roots grow deep and slow, and the results of that growth are not necessarily predictable. That's one of the reasons why I love our breathing time. It feels just like this tiny little dose of a much-needed antidote to hurry, 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 hurry. We need this. Also not a commentary on participating or not participating, by the way. We don't all need it in the same shape, even if we all need it. There's one other thing about going too fast that I've been thinking about. When we don't slow down to reflect or recover, I think it gets very difficult for us to embody or encounter that for which we might choose to use God language, the divine isness. I think it gets more challenging to incarnate things like great peace or beauty or mercy or justice. And I think going too fast, too much, makes us uniquely vulnerable to being told who our enemies should be and how we ought to feel about them and how we should treat them. I don't know if those pieces feel like they fit together in your imagination, but in mine they do. I don't know if you remember this. If you're a guest this morning, you certainly won't, but if you've been part of the community over time, this feels like it was a long time ago. It was, you know, before the holidays. We were exploring some ideas that had to do with welcoming those we might experience as the stranger. And of course, one of the ways we experience people that we might think of as strangers to us is as the enemy. Now, it's not the only way. but it's not an uncommon way. And I said then that I wanted to get to a particular Jesus story about this. So that's where I'm going to start this morning. This morning is basically an on-ramp to that story. So we'll just barely touch the story this week, and we'll kind of get into it a little more next week. But I wanted to kind of open this up a little bit. And the way that I want to do that this morning is with a poem. You're so lucky. Sorry, again, for people that aren't always part of the community, there's a couple things I like to nerd out on once in a while. Poetry is one of them. Words are another. You get both this morning. So this is like a big morning, okay? This is really special. Anyway, I ran across a poem that feels like it helps me to personally slow down and look deeper. And I was one of those times, and this doesn't always happen, just because something's a poem doesn't mean that it strikes people who like poetry. I mean, just because something is a song doesn't mean you like it if you like music, right? But this particular poem, wherever I encountered it, and I can't remember where I saw it for the first time, but I was reading along in something, and this poem was part of it, and I read the poem, and I was like, and I didn't have time to kind of engage with it, but it was just like instantly just struck me. So I copied it and I emailed it to myself so I'd be able to find it later. I've learned since that it was published in a collection of work called Conflict Resolution for Holy Beings, Poems. More about the poet in a moment, but first the poem, which is, for those not drawn to poetry, there are some of you I know, it is both mercifully short and quite accessible. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read it first, and I want you to just listen to it. We'll put it on the screen after. We'll read it through twice. But first pass, just listen. And there's a reason for that. How many of you are familiar with the writer C.S. Lewis in some way or other? Lewis had this interesting rationale for reading something more than once. He said, the first time you read it, and this is a curious phrase, this is clearly a man who felt strongly about literature. The first time you read something, you read it to satiate, this is a quote, satiate your narrative lust. This is not, you know, a lusty poem in some, you know, adults only kind of way. But the word, of course, means far more than that, right? And so that's what Lewis is talking about. It's like the first pass of something that's written down might just, if you let it, might just seep into places where you are hungry and thirsty and longing, you know? And once something kind of gets a little bit saturated and we're not just like, I'm dying, then we can come back to it and think about it, right? So just close your eyes if that helps you listen. Be still. I'll read it for us once. We'll put it up on the screen, then we're going to do a little bit of work with that, okay? The poem is called This Morning I Pray for My Enemies. This morning, I pray for my enemies. And whom do I call my enemy? An enemy must be worthy of engagement. I turn in the direction of the sun and keep walking. It's the heart that asks the question, not my furious mind. The heart is the smaller cousin of the sun. It sees and knows everything. It hears the gnashing, even as it hears the blessing. The door to the mind should only open from the heart. An enemy who gets in risks the danger of becoming a friend. Judy, would you put that up? Poems are meant to be seen as well as to be heard. Most poets, I think, would agree. So I'm going to read it for us one more time with it in front of us. And the reason I read the title as part of the poem is because I think that was the poet's intent. This morning, I pray for my enemies. And whom do I call my enemy? An enemy must be worthy of engagement. I turn in the direction of the sun and keep walking. It's my heart that asks the question, not my furious mind. The heart is the smaller cousin of the sun. It sees and knows everything. It hears the gnashing, even as it hears the blessing. The door to the mind should only open from the heart. An enemy who gets in risks the danger of becoming a friend. We'll just leave that up. The poet is Joy Harjo, someone I'd never heard of before I encountered this particular poem. Harjo, though, it turns out, is a fairly celebrated contemporary American poet. She was, among many other accolades and awards, named the U.S. Poet Laureate in June of 2019. So a well-known poet in context. She's a member of the Muscogee or Creek Nation, and she draws deeply on her indigeneity in her work. She's also, this is kind of a fun fact about Joy Harjo, she's also a pretty mean saxophone player and a jazz musician, and she's currently working on a musical play. So remember that she's indigenous, okay? So she's, and when you hear the title of this, she's working on a musical play called We Were There When Jazz Was Invented, which just, I want to see the finished work, because what an intersection, anyway. So that's the poet, a little bit. I mention all of that because it feels important to me to point out that Harjo, like all of us, doesn't make anything in a vacuum. She says it this way, quote, "I feel strongly that I have a responsibility to all the sources that I am, to all past and future ancestors, to my home country, to all places that I touch down on and that are myself, to all voices, all women, all of my tribe, all people, all earth, and beyond that, to all beginnings and endings. We work at the intersections of what we know, what we're experiencing, our history, and our present context." And so when Harjo says, an enemy must be worthy of engagement, and I think she's using the image of engagement there almost militarily, all right? She's actually talking about like getting involved with an enemy, all right? So when she says an enemy must be worthy of engagement, my sense as a person or person with settler heritage is that my imagination needs to be attentive to the little bit I know about the history of her people being treated as enemies, and to consider some of what a person with that kind of shared history, which Harjo has, what that person might have to wrestle with before deciding who is worthy of engagement. Context. That's part of her context, and it's an important part. I'm going to mostly skip over the middle of the poem for now. It's worth working through, especially because it reminds us of the important and sometimes complex relationship between our heart and our mind. But I'm not going to start there. I'm going to start closer to the top. When Harjo asks, "And whom do I call my enemy?" the word enemy is an interesting one. Poets don't tend to throw words away. These are pretty thoughtful about all the words. The word enemy comes from, wait for it, the Latin. It actually does come from the Latin inimicus. And inimicus, and this is where it gets great, inimicus means bad friend. So the word enemy comes from a root meaning bad friend. One way to think about that is consider how we depend on our knowledge of what friend means in order to understand its contrast or its rival, enemy, right? This is a bit akin linguistically to a word like atheism. So Latin for without, or sort of a negating word, and theism, which contains the Latin word for God. So the very word that says there is no such thing contains that thing as an idea. Atheist, no God. Atheism. So it's kind of like that. It's one of those kind of words. All of this feels to me like it leads us, first of all, into considering, under Harjo's good direction here, who might truly be regarded as our enemy, not just as some kind of adversarial figure that comes into our story to help us grow as people, because I don't think that's a really great use of the idea of enemy, right? There are people that come into our path, and we feel the resistance of that person, or we feel that they rub us the wrong way, or this is just a hard thing relationally, or their ideas are different than mine, and that's difficult. And when we kind of grow a little bit, we go, you know, mostly that served as growth. I don't think that's what Harjo's talking about. And the reason I would say that is because she's asking the question, who is it in my life for which I will use that word, and I will only use that word for those that I regard as qualifying to be engaged with enmity. Because engaging someone as an enemy comes with risks, doesn't it? And out of that, I think this kind of stream that I'm on here leads us to ask the question, how might I make an enemy into a friend? And that feels like a pretty timely question to me. I think that our too-fast world is very pleased to tell us over and over again who our enemies are or who they should be. And it often does that in ways that might encourage us to skip right over the harder work of contemplating whether the person I'm being told should be my enemy might actually, or not, be worthy of engaging with as an enemy. But to ask the question, how might I make an enemy into a friend, that happens way less often. And it raises other questions. If I am willing to entertain that possibility, what might be the risks? What might be the dangers? What might be the process? What might be the rewards? And why is this so important? Why don't we just acknowledge that having an enemy is part of life and get on with working at being the strong one so we can clobber our enemies, so we can win? And I'm not going to dig into this today, but I think even a cursory glance at most of the large conflicts in the news cycle this week can show us how win-lose is starting to reveal itself as lose-lose in more and more instances. That's not a new idea. Most of the wise ones aren't. Maybe it just sounds surprising when we've been hosed down with the rhetoric of it's the winners that matter. And we've been hosed down with that idea for so long and so insistently that we've forgotten to pay attention to what the humans before us have learned by hard experience and what they're perfectly willing to share if we'll pay attention. And one of those lessons that keeps cropping up in the wise ones is being stronger does not make you righter. That's a truth that shows up in lots of ancient texts, including some ancient Hebrew ones upon which Christian tradition stands. One of those texts, and we explored this before the end of last year, one of those texts gives God a voice which says, you shall not wrong a stranger or oppress him or her or them. Don't do that. Now, that's not the only tradition to promote that wisdom. We've considered this here before. Nearly all of the world's enduring religious or spiritual traditions contain some version of treat others the way you want to be treated. It's probably the most commonly shared, commonly held religious idea that we know of. If we're going to put that into the context of what we're exploring today, we could say that it means that if you would prefer that someone truly gets to know you, to know your setting, to know your history, to know your motives, to know your choices and your actions, to know what we might call your heart, before they decide whether they are going to declare you their enemy, then probably we should do the same. That's the long version of do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And one of the places where I'm headed with all of this is toward a Jesus story in which Jesus takes on the same subject, and he does it in a way that really bugs people. We'll get to the particulars of that story next week, but I want to hint at one aspect of it this morning. This is a story in which, and again, we'll kind of unpack this more next week, but this is a story in which we find that Jesus speaks as a prophet, not as a Messiah. Messiah is not a claim that Jesus made for themselves, by the way. We can talk about that another time. But in the context of this story, it's an important distinction, not least of all because the thing that the Old Testament prophets did is something any one of us can do, even if we might not kind of get as carried away in the process as some of them did. In very simple terms, what the prophets did, what that tradition is about, is they spoke the truth as they saw it and experienced it around them, even when that didn't match the prevailing norms or the rhetoric that was explaining those norms. That's what they did. They did what we've maybe come to know more commonly as speaking truth to power. That's what it meant to be a prophet. So even when the news says, think of it this way, we can choose to reflect on what's underneath and behind the headlines and to speak from the vantage point of our own reflections and our own experience. And within the Hebrew tradition, this sort of seeing through to the heart of things is understood in that tradition as a way that the divine becomes visible in the world. And that's a pretty interesting idea, that somewhere in this practice of saying, that's not how it looks to me, we have a chance to glimpse something greater than us. There's this really great story in the book of 1 Samuel where the prophet Samuel gets this, you know, mission from God, and he's supposed to go and select the next king for the people. Thank you, Tim and Zach. Anybody else enjoy the Blues Brothers? Anyway, yes, that's what that was. So his mission from God is to go and select the next king for the people. And the story starts with God telling Samuel off. And he's telling him off because Samuel's stuck. He's like whining about the current king. Because the current king's still on the throne, but his leadership has gone off the rails long since. And Samuel's just like, about it, you know? And God basically says, get off your butt and go find the next one. Like, do something about it, right? Speak some truth to power. Act it out. So the story is in 1 Samuel 16 if you want to read it in detail, but lots of you probably have some childhood version of this floating around in your head. By the way, interesting thing about stories that we have in our head and where we learn them, this is about context. The childhood version you have floating around in your head, if you grew up inside of traditional Christianity, probably reads a little bit like God comes along and rescues people. Well, that's kind of a reassuring version of the story, and lots of these stories can be told that way. But you know, sometimes we need to go back to the childhood version we have in our head, and we need to reconsider it, and we need to tell ourselves a different version of it. And lots of times when we tell ourselves a different version of it, the most fundamental change is that the things in the story that God takes responsibility for in the childhood version turn into things that we're supposed to take care of in the adult version. And that's sort of what happens in this story. So, the kid version, we're not going to spend any more time on. We're just going to get right into it. So, Samuel is trying to find the right person to lead the nation. That's sort of the job that he's been given by God. And as usual, the nation is having trouble with their enemies, and it seems like this idea that stronger is righter is old enough that it's around even then. So when Samuel goes looking for a king, he's on the lookout for the kind of guy that can crush all the enemies. And all the typical male stereotypes apply in Samuel's imagination. He is looking for tall and burly and strong, and that's the criteria he clearly has in mind in the story. But after the first seven interviewees get rejected by Samuel's boss, God, this harp-playing, contemplative, poetry-writing juvenile with great skin and beautiful eyes. Go read the story. This is how they're described. Great skin and beautiful eyes gets brought in, and God says, that's the one. And the rationale that the text provides for God's decision is this, patriarchal language warning. The Lord sees not as man sees. Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart. In other words, the way the divine shows up in this story is by compelling the human being, in this case Samuel, that has the responsibility to speak and act on behalf of the people that were being marginalized and abused by the present despot. The divine shows up in the story by compelling that person to take on a process that slows them down long enough to get past the bold print ideas about how to deal with enemies, which is by being stronger / righter, and to consider an alternative. Whatever else there is about the shape of this story that might kind of get our imaginations going about how to live different, if we think about the God character in this, because it has lots of the shape of the fable. I mean, even the numbers match those shapes, right? How many people go through the cycle before you get the winner and all of that. It's all there in the story shape. But why trot out the first seven, you know, losing candidates? Like, why bother with that in the shape of the story? Maybe it's to make the point about the process. Maybe the lesson's in the shape of the story. Slow down. This is going to take some practice. all those stereotypes we have about how this thing with enemies and friends should work. You don't just unravel it because you get a new single idea, and then it's not a binary experience. It's not like one day we're going to operate this way around enemy and friend, and the next day we're going to just flip it over and operate different. I mean, maybe you can do that. I cannot do that. That's not the way change works in me. That's not the way change seems to work around me. We've got to have these first seven candidates before we go, I have never thought of it that way before. I've never been able to consider this that way before. That criteria does not match what I'm imagining. That criteria doesn't even match my previous experience. Previous experience have given me trouble right now, right? And that's sort of what's happening in the Samuel story. The king that's on the throne kind of matched all that archetypal criteria. They kind of had all the burly going on. They had all the stronger is righter stuff going on. And they were tanking. That's a little dissonant, right? The picture I had isn't working. That's lots of times where change starts. But then sometimes we need this process where it's like, but maybe something close to that. Maybe something a little further from that. Maybe something really far. Maybe who brought out the harp-playing juvenile with the great skin and the beautiful eyes and thought this was a good idea? That's nowhere near the criteria I went into this looking for the next king with. God's voice in character's ear as one. Rethink it. You know? And the interesting thing about these ancient texts is that they're full of stories like that, that make you just, if you pay attention to the process in them, make you go, oh. Maybe change works kind of like that. Back to Joy Harjo's poem. The alternative to I arrived with all these criteria intact for who's my enemy and who's my friend, to use the shorthand of the text, the alternative to coming in with my ideas, my mind about this made up intact, is to look on the heart. Harjo says it this way, in whom do I call my enemy? An enemy must be worthy of engagement. I turn in the direction of the sun and keep walking. Now, listen to this part. It's the heart that asks the question. What question? The question, whom do I call my enemy? It's the heart that asks the question, not my furious mind. In other words, if I'm going to ask this question deeply, who is my enemy and who will I engage with enmity? The questioner in me needs to not be, first of all, my ideas about that person, but my heart. The heart, Harjo says, is the smaller cousin of the sun. Everything revolves around this. It sees and knows everything. It hears the gnashing, even as it hears the blessing. The door to the mind should only open from the heart. An enemy who gets in risks the danger of becoming a friend. When it comes to seeing enemies differently, so differently that I don't succumb to the knee-jerk reaction of just blazing away first, but rather ask first, is this person really my enemy? Is this person really worthy of engaging in that way with all of its attendant risks? And then also asking the companion question, how might I make an enemy into a friend? The insight here is that when it comes to seeing that differently, I have to be willing to look on the heart. Whose heart? Well, first of all, my own. The heart, Harjo just reminded us, is what the rest revolves around. It's what sees and knows everything that matters most. It's what has the capacity for complexity beyond what an algorithm can bear. Even the sorts of situations that contain both grinding and blessing. I don't know about you, but I don't have to think very long to think of some of those. It's our heart that need to be in charge of answering the question, who is my enemy? And that's important because when we slow down enough to come at it that way, one of the things that is more likely to happen is that we will begin to ask questions about our heart, first of all, but then also about the heart of our so-called enemies. And when we do that, I want to say we're just traveling on a different road altogether. And I think it's a road that still leads to our mind. This is not an anti-thinking road. But it's a road that leads to our mind only after it passes through the heart. In other words, it's the road on which the bad friend is given the opportunity to enter our heart, to be considered in light of their heart, their feelings, their experiences, their context, before my mind about them is made up. And on that road, any enemy that gets in risks the danger of becoming a friend. This looking on the heart, says the story about Samuel, this is the way that the great good, that the great peace, that the great love can be seen to be present in the world. None of those are things that we summon, but they are things that if we do not attend to them, we might be completely unaware of. That's our deal. And I hope we're going to see, among other things, that in next week's exploration, there's a real kinship with these ideas to the way that Jesus sees similar questions. And that sometimes that does not sit very well with the prevailing norms. And we'll get to that next week. Peace.